Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, November 4th, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. We're very pleased to welcome our expert today, J. Christian Adams, from the Election Law Center. He's going to give us opening remarks of about 10 minutes or so, but as always, we'll be turning to the audience for questions, so do be thinking of your questions. With that, Mr. Adams, the floor is yours.
Good afternoon, everybody, and if you are on Guam, good morning, where it is now 2 a.m. The traditional greeting on Guam is the term half a day, which I always think is useful to remember what time it is there. It's usually a half a day plus 2 hours in time difference from the East Coast. The case we're going to discuss today is in the United States District Court in Guam. It is called Arnold Davis versus Guam. It is a case that was filed by me and Michael Rossman at the Center for Individual Rights, along with a local counsel by the name of Munsu Park. The client, Dave Davis, is a retired Air Force major who served on Guam at the air base and is challenging a voting statute by himself without the help of the usual civil rights groups. It is a quirky case at first, but it has strategic implications for the United States because it is part, I will tell you, of a sort of native islander separatist movement that is taking place not only in Guam, but once again in Hawaii. Those of you who have not been to Guam or not been in the military, Guam has Anderson Air Base, which is the tip of the American strategic spear in the Pacific, with active exercises of B-2 bombers, B-1 bombers, B-52 bombers. I've been on the flight line watching F-22s from Alaska conducting exercises with Japanese F-16s, and given the history of the island, it's pretty much a sight to behold. It's also the only deep water port between Manila and Pearl Harbor, and it has a huge naval base there. What is happening is the separatists are trying to force a reexamination of the relationship of Guam to the United States without letting most American citizens vote who are either Filipino, black, or white. And it also shows you, just when you think a conservative majority on the Supreme Court has resolved an issue, sometimes it really hasn't. And of course, I'm referring to the case of Rice v. Cayetano, where this sort of nonsense was struck down by the Supreme Court about 15 years ago. These are the facts. Guam is planning a plebiscite, an election, to, quote, ascertain the wishes about the future relationship with the United States. And not surprisingly, the status quo is not on the ballot. Guam is an unincorporated territory. Congress basically decides what happens on Guam, and there's a measure of limited self-government pursuant to what's called the Organic Act of 1950. The choices for this plebiscite are statehood, free association, or independence. So in other words, either become a state, leave, or set the terms of your own relationship with the United States. Now, our client, Major Davis, is not allowed to vote in this election because only native inhabitants can. And you might ask, what is a native inhabitant? Well, think back to Jim Crow. It's like the one drop rule. In the old days, one drop of black ancestry disqualified you to vote, but in this case, one drop of the right ancestry qualifies you to vote. If you are a descendant of somebody who lived on Guam in 1950 and who became a U.S. citizen, that's important. The Organic Act of Guam in 1950 made a group of people who lived there who weren't citizens, citizens, and it just so happens that about 99% of them were of a single race. Now, Guam is covered by the Organic Act. It's an act of Congress. It's codified in U.S. Code. If you have the U.S. Code on your bookshelf, it's right there. And we have brought about essentially 9 claims challenging this one-drop rule under a variety of statutes, essentially Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, the intent and effect prong, the 15th Amendment. We've challenged under the 14th Amendment. We've challenged under 2 provisions of the Civil Rights Act of 1957 and 3 provisions from within the Guam Organic Act. So there's essentially 9 causes of action. Guam originally claimed that because the election wasn't scheduled, it set off at an indefinite date with a triggering formula, that the claim wasn't ripe. And because the plebiscite itself was non-binding, it essentially tells Congress and the president, this is what we want to do, then there was no real dispute, that there wasn't really a fight here, no case or controversy. And the District Court of Guam actually agreed on a Rule 12 motion. But thanks to the good work of Scott Martin and Doug Cox at Gibson Dunn, the Ninth Circuit reversed and remanded in an opinion by Judge Kaczynski, who was joined by Judge Schroeder, and unfortunately there was a dissent by Judge Smith. And the Ninth Circuit held that the case was ripe whenever a government treats you differently. And it also held that the election had real effects, that there was a case or controversy, because it would trigger a very specific government action directed toward the Congress and the president. So last September, we had summary judgment arguments in Guam and are currently awaiting an opinion. And essentially, there are 9 claims, as I mentioned earlier, and I thought I would go through what the claims are briefly, tell you the defenses, and then open it up for questions. First of all, like they did in Rice v. Cayetano, we're arguing that ancestry tests are banned by the 15th Amendment per se. You can't have voting tied to ancestry. I always find it curious that none of the usual civil rights groups are very interested in this case, nor Eric Holder's Justice Department. But you would think that it doesn't get any worse than a grandfather clause to give you the right to vote under the 15th Amendment. We're also alleging it violates the 14th Amendment because the law treats people differently when it relates to the right to vote and there's no compelling state interest. Under the Voting Rights Act, we've alleged that it has the effect and intent of racial discrimination. There's actually 3 provisions of the Organic Act. You can't have any qualifications to vote regarding property or income, and you can only have citizenship, civil capacity, and residence. And we're saying none of these are those 3 permissible ones. The Organic Act also incorporates the Constitution, in case you were wondering, the 14th and 15th Amendment. There's explicit incorporation. And the 2 provisions of the 1957 Civil Rights Act, if you're allowed to vote in any election, you must be allowed to vote in all elections without regard to race. And lastly, you can't have different procedures for different elections under the 57 Civil Rights Act. So what is Guam's defense? Well, first of all, they say this is not a racial classification. It's temporal. It's a political class. If your ancestors were a group of political people in 1950, then you're allowed to vote in this election. And that ancestry tests, and this is important to understand because it's sort of a pretty extreme argument, are allowed because of the voiceless nature of the displaced culture and peoples. Sounds familiar, I suppose, if you've been paying attention to what's going on campuses. So pay attention to this because the same argument could probably be domesticated into the United States in the future to some more balkanized portions of the country. The 14th Amendment defense is they're saying, hey, it's a compelling state interest to gauge the wishes of the colonized native inhabitants. I don't think they have very good arguments on narrow tailoring, and we cite lots of less intrusive means, such as doing a poll to gauge these wishes, but they say it's okay to take polls of subsets of racial groups, and it's a compelling state interest. They also say, that is a defense, that there are international obligations on the colonizer. That's a term they like to use. To decolonize and allow elections that only the colonized can vote in. And if the Constitution conflicts with international agreements, well, the Constitution has to give way. And that's another one of their defenses. They also defend the statute by saying the territories are not covered by Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act and one of the provisions of the 57 Civil Rights Act. It's actually probably their strongest argument because of some statutory interpretation issues, but it only implicates 2 of the 9 causes of action, and if we win on any of the other 7, we still win the case. Finally, they claim that the Organic Act of Guam is not offended because it's really a civil capacity or citizenship qualification. They don't really explain why or how, but it just feels like it is, and therefore, that this is a permissible qualification under the Voting Rights Act. Let me close and say that there's a very similar case in the CNMI, the Commonwealth of Northern Marianas, which the federal court has already ruled on, essentially to what would be our favor. And now the CNMI is a little different than Guam, but the judges there and both federal judges tend to follow each other on a lot of issues. So I think it's a harbinger of a positive case ruling on summary judgment, which I expect soon after the election. But this will probably go up, and it will probably have implications for territorial issues, what sort of racial arguments could be made in courts to give people a set-aside, if you will, politically. It will have implications for strategic relationships with Anderson and with the naval base there. So with that, let me close, and I hope that was a decent explanation and open to your questions.
Very good. Thank you for those opening thoughts. In a moment, we'll hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for our expert, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our expert, you need to push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. While we wait to see if someone rings in, let me talk about our upcoming schedule. Next Monday at 2 Eastern Time, we'll have a special Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum looking at the NLRB versus SDW general case that will be argued on Monday. Our Teleforum will be at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. That case is interesting because it concerns President Obama's appointment of an acting general counsel at NLRB his involvement in some cases. Today, of course, we're talking about voting on Guam. We have one question pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's take our first call of the day. Caller, if you have your telephone muted, you need to come off mute. We can't hear you. We have a caller from 760. We can't hear your question. If your phone is muted, you need to unmute your own telephone. Okay. Let's skip over that. We might have some technical difficulties there. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We'll get to you as soon as possible. Let me ask a question then. You mentioned, I think, at the during your opening remarks that there is no scheduled election. Then you mentioned this case will be decided after the election. I think I just want to clarify proposed referendum on future status of Guam is sort of an abstract thing in terms of the date, and the decision you mentioned of the court will likely occur after the presidential election, these elections on November 8th. Have I got that right?
Yes, and this is what the defense based their whole case on early on, and of course the Ninth Circuit reversed and said that as soon as government treats you differently, then you are ripe and you can bring a claim. There is a strange triggering formula where they need 70% of the native inhabitants to register for this election. But what they've done is to actually juice the voting rolls a bit by, and this is a whole other topic, something from the Chamorro Land Trust. There is a racial set-aside of land there, which actually saw the only African-American thrown out of his house in the last couple of years after his Chamorro wife died, because he was on Chamorro lands. And anybody who's on the Chamorro Land Trust rolls, which is an explicitly racial list, is populated onto the voting rolls. And so they're doing all they can to reach the triggers to have the election. And they're constantly trying to find new ways to reach the triggers.
Once again, I think we can hear now the caller from number 760. You have a question, caller? Okay, perhaps not. So once again, if you're in the audience, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. While we wait to see if anyone wants to ring in, let me ask another question, and that goes to the Native Hawaiian separatist movement. And I think there's some legislation, or there has been in the past. It's sort of been introduced, withdrawn, reintroduced, never really passed. Is this case in Guam related to that sort of movement in Hawaii? And one question in particular I have, part of the Hawaiian separatist movement, as I understand it, goes to a critique of the 1959 referendum during which Hawaiian there was a vote on the island of Hawaii to become a state. And people in the present day are critiquing that vote, saying that it was flooded by non-Hawaiians. So maybe you can address some of those issues if you're...
The Akaka Bill was always the legislative vehicle for creating essentially a Native Hawaiian tribe that would be a federally recognized tribe. It always failed in Congress, so it never became law. But as we know over the last couple of years, whether or not something became law doesn't matter as much as whether you have federal agencies who will implement it as if it were the law. And so what has happened is the Department of the Interior, and sometimes through the Justice Department, have taken a position that Native Hawaiians are indeed entitled to some special status, the degree to which is still up for debate. And thus, there was a movement to have an election in the last year or two that was very similar to the one in Guam. And I know Judicial Watch sued Hawaii. It didn't come quite out the way we all would have wanted, but at the same time, it seemed to manage to scuttle the election. The Supreme Court actually issued a stay on tabulating the ballots. I think Justice Kennedy was the supervising justice on that stay within the last year or so. So it demonstrates that this is a bubbling movement. It's not some quirky thing that I just happen to be dealing with halfway around the world. It's part of a coordinated effort between Native Hawaiian activists and Chamorro activists on Guam to erode the relationship of these Pacific islands with the United States.
And that maybe extends to the Marianas. You mentioned a case there. How long ago was that case?
Well, the Marianas are a strange circumstance because they were a trust territory, and they were governed by a United Nations trust that allowed for all sorts of racial discrimination, of which is probably beyond the scope of this call. But it's not quite the same thing because they were permitted to racially discriminate on a lot of fronts. When it came to land ownership, for example, you can't own land in the CNMI unless you're a native inhabitant. So it's a little bit of a different circumstance there because they have one foot into like international sovereignty.
That's interesting. And that geographically, for my benefit, Marianas are very close to Guam. Is that correct, geographically?
They are. As I like to say, they're about a three-hour jet flight from Tokyo south and a six-hour B-29 flight. They were the air bases during the B-29 strategic firebombings in Japan. The Marianas, Guam, and Tinian is where the Enola Gay took off from in Boxcar. They were the strategic landing strips for those campaigns.
It does sort of underscore the strategic value of some of these islands to the United States interests. And you describe them as the spearhead, which means by which I take it you mean the furthest point west in the Pacific where we have a military presence?
A military presence that is sovereign U.S. territory. We have a presence, of course, in Okinawa,
right.
But it's Guam where the nuclear bombers go in times of crisis and operate from, and it's Guam where the deep water American flag port is between Pearl and Manila.
Right. We do have one question pending. We'll go to that in a moment. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's try again to take our first call of the day.
Good morning. Can you hear me, Chris?
Yes.
All right. Thank you for doing this. I am a good friend of Arnold Davis and a former resident of Guam, and I'm very pleased that you've taken these cases. One brief preliminary comment and then a question. Also, for constitutional lawyers to note, there are three important deviations from the Constitution up in the CNMI. You mentioned land ownership, but there also are restrictions on who gets a jury trial there. And by congressional statute, the legislature of the CNMI is a Baker v. Carr violation. There is not equal representation of all people. Two smaller islands are given extraordinary power in the CNMI legislature in order to preserve the unity, so-called unity, the islands. But that's an interesting side note. But the thing I would like to ask you about is that Dave Davis had a remarkable experience with the Civil Rights Division, as you're well aware. The voting rights staff at the Justice Department treated this case like a nuclear bomb. Nobody wanted to get near it, or like a biological weapon. They felt that to aggressively push this case to the political leadership would be a career killer. I wondered if you could tell the people that are listening in about some of the history of this case at the Civil Rights Division in the Holder Justice Department. Thank you.
Well, look, I mean, as many of you know, I did the new Black Panther case, and I testified under oath, as did other colleagues of mine, that this was an administration that wasn't going to bring cases that have plaintiffs or victims who look like Dave Davis. And there is more than just voting here. There's the Chamorro Land Trust, where good lawyers at the Civil Rights Division have been pressing political leadership and SES leadership, like a fellow by the name of Steve Rosenbaum, who runs the housing section, and they simply won't do anything about this case. They won't do anything about the voting case because the victim is the wrong color. It's why you don't see civil rights groups involved like the NAACP. If this were Alabama and you had a plebiscite on what the Alabama university system would be, and you could only vote in it if you had a ancestor who attended the University of Alabama, you know, in 1950 or 1850, you can be sure that every single one of the civil rights groups would be on the side of bringing a case. But here in Guam, because the victim is the wrong color, the NAACP, the ACLU, the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division are wholly uninterested, and explicitly so. I was at the Justice Department. I knew what their attitude was about these kind of cases.
Thank you. That's very helpful, and it's good to know. I mean, I worked for 13 years in another part of the Justice Department as a trial lawyer in the Antitrust Division, and we occasionally had some political interference, but it was largely because of economic disputes on the economics of a case, and it never was as offensive as it appears to be. I think you've also noted in some things I've seen you either write or talk about that they're very difficult to bring some cases. I think there was a case in Mississippi where there was essentially an African-American political machine that was discriminating, and it was very difficult to get that case brought. Is that true?
Well, that's a whole other saga that is not related to Guam, but yes, I covered it in the book. That's United States versus Ike Brown. We won that case in the United States District Court in the Southern District of Mississippi, Fifth Circuit affirmed, and it was viewed, and it was the first case under the Voting Rights Act brought to help white victims. And if you read the case, the citations online are in my book, you will get a glimpse of what it is like when the shoe is on the other foot and doing the kicking.
Thank you. Also, another side comment is that the district court on Guam seems uniquely unwilling to rule on this case. Do you want to comment about that? I know that's maybe a difficult issue as we're waiting for the decision.
Well, my comments will be restrained on that one, but I will tell you that I think there is some wisdom in letting this election go by before ruling, because I cannot overstate how incendiary this topic is on the island. It drives the political dynamics, not necessarily the plebiscite terms, but the whole movement is the touchstone for a small group of very loud activists that change the entire political atmosphere on the island. They might only be 10%, but they're definitely the loudest 10%, and so very few politicians are willing to cross them. And I think it is probably wise that the judge has decided to seemingly wait until after the election, because all 15 members of the Guam Senate are up for election. They have a 15-member at-large Senate, and if she were to rule on this before the election, it would definitely become an issue in the election, the topic we've heard so much about in the last week.
Well, you know, the at-large election of senators on Guam is likely also a voting rights violation because it clearly disenfranchises the fairly large Filipino-American population that lives on the island.
Well, I don't disagree, but the problem is, as a practical matter, there's no census blocks to do a Jingles 1 analysis or even do racially polarized voting analysis. It's very difficult to develop a Section 2 case there, but particularly so because it's questionable whether Section 2, as Guam has defended, even applies to Guam.
Thank you.
Let me make another call for questions. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open now. Our guest mentioned his book, the name of that, in case you're wondering, Injustice, Exposing the Racial Agenda of the Obama Justice Department. I think if you search Injustice or J. Christian Adams on Amazon or booksellers everywhere, you'll be able to find that. Again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. This would be our final call for questions. I think we've had our final question. Mr. Adams, do you want to take a minute or two to express a final thought, wrap up?
No, I think that, you know, when you first hear about this case and you hear about what's going on in Guam, you tend to think, well, that's a faraway place. But the closer you get to the case and over the last couple of years, I think you can see some of the same trend lines, ideas, legal defenses, academic arguments that are being used by Guam popping up in other places stateside. And I think that for those of us who believe in the rule of law, the power of the 15th and the Civil War amendments to treat everybody equally, we ignore things that are going on in the Pacific at our own hazard.
Very good. Well, it's been a pleasure. Certainly an informative discussion here. I thank you for joining us today, Mr. Christian Adams. Again, the title of the book, I think if you search for Injustice, J. Christian Adams, you will get there. Thank you to the audience as well for joining us and for your questions. A reminder to our audience about our next scheduled Teleforum conference call. That's Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. A Courthouse Steps Teleforum will be talking about an NLRB case and presidential appointment power under the Vacancies Act. But until the next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.